Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. I'd like to welcome, joining us by telephone, author, journalist, and cultural observer Gail Sheehy. She's the author of many books, including the bestseller Passages, and most recently, Sex and the Seasoned Woman. And she will be speaking at the James A. Little Theater, sponsored by the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum, in a talk called The Pursuit of the Passionate Life. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm happy to be with you, and soon to be with you in person in that lovely part of the world.
Yes, indeed. We're very happy to have you. In your book, Sex and the Seasoned Woman, you write about what you call second adulthood, which happens around when people reach midlife. What is the second adulthood, and how is it different from the first one?
Well, you know, today people don't really accept being adult until about 30, and I give as my evidence the fact that the U.S. Census Bureau has found that one-third of baby boomers who are now in their early 40s to early 60s are supporting fully at least one adult child, and two-thirds of them are partially or fully supporting at least one adult child. So, and their children are, you know, in their 20s up to 30. So I think that puts the data underneath something I've been noticing for a long time, and so have a lot of other parents. So the first adulthood really begins around 30 and goes to about 50, when you're, you know, settling on your course in life, and if you're married, building a family and building your reputation, trying to get into a senior position. And then really you have a chance to start all over again around 50. And it's particularly dramatic for women because of the hormonal change of 50 and because the average age at which the last child is put on the plane or train to go off to school or some sort of independent life is in the early to mid-50s. And that's the time that women just take off. It's like a booster rocket. Margaret Mead called it postmenopausal zest. But a lot of it has to do with at last being able to find out who you want to be, who you were when you started out before you became wrapped up in the roles and rules of first adulthood. And it's the time when women feel, often for the first time, free to make choices for themselves without guilt.
It's very interesting how things change from one generation to the next and really how quickly they change. I was rereading Passages, which is from about 30 years ago, and it seems, for example, you have the what you call the catch 30, which is the time that a lot of married couples seem to hit a crisis point around the age of 30. What was the nature of that crisis, and how have things changed since then?
Well, at that time, most women married shortly after college, if they even went to college, or if they escaped becoming pregnant before they ever got to go to college. And so they would normally put their own continuing education and early career experimentation aside to be the baby maker and have children in their 20s into early 30s was even sort of late. And so by the time the couple got to 30, they'd usually been married 7 years, and everybody wanted to be something more. I mean, men and women. It's still true at 30. That is the underlying nature of the passage at 30 because you have been spending your 20s proving yourself and trying on different career paths and partners. And at 30, you have to kind of get serious. And the choices you made in your 20s may seem confining. They almost always do. Even though they may have been choices that were perfectly well suited to that earlier stage of the tryout 20s. But at that time, most people had been married for 5 to 7 years. And so the tension that is normal for each of us to feel around 30 as we want to be something more, as we want to revisit and possibly refresh and possibly tear up the choices of our 20s because we now are more clear about the direction we'd like to go. When that played out within a marriage, it often broke up the marriage.
We're talking to Gail Sheehy. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, when you when one reads passages, or really any of your books, but especially that book, which is now three decades old, there's such vivid portraits of the people whom you describe and whom you interview. Did you keep in touch with any of those people? Is there any follow-up about their lives?
Well, sometimes it happens just as a result of my traveling around the country doing speeches and lectures or group interviews. For instance, the family that was called the Babcocks in the book, they were the very first family that was described, and it was the two generations, the parents who were the World War II generation and the young people who were Boomer generation, their son and daughter, and describing how they were each, you know, had experienced the passages of early adulthood and how the younger generation was very different in the way they looked at things. I just ran into the daughter of the parents in that book and found that they were still flourishing. They had gotten through the late midlife crisis that I described in passages where the husband, I think, was had gotten ill and he was being retired and he was feeling, you know, worn out and over. And his wife was gardening at midnight behind their condo to sort of keep herself occupied, not climbing the walls.
Amazing.
And, you know, they survived that. Their kids got better. Their kids came out of their, you know, whatever little normal, predictable crisis was going on in their younger lives. And they're all still flourishing. So it was just delightful to have that affirmation that once you make a passage or two or three times, the more times you make them, and you realize that, you know, once you get out of the disequilibrium and confusion, that you find another path and you're stronger for it.
Now, I would think one of the things that affected the people whom you wrote about was the fact of being interviewed and the fact of observing your life more closely than you would have otherwise. I mean, that would, I think, affect the course of one's life.
Right. That's very true. Because I, you know, my approach is, since I'm not a therapist and I'm not a clinician, I'm not an academic, I'm a partner in exploring a person's life stage by stage. What I can provide is some kind of a framework to understand the different stages and what might be a passage and work in a partnership with the person I'm interviewing to kind of decode the patterns in their life. It is something that gives me a great deal, but it seems to, you know, give something rather memorable to my interviewees.
Now, the baby boom generation has had to deal with a number of what you might call double-edged swords. For example, on the one hand, a higher divorce rate that brings, you know, heartbreak, instability, and all kinds of pain. And on the other hand, new possibilities for freedom and exploration and so on, especially for women, as you've said. Mm-hmm. Do you see at this point in our social history and the turmoil that we've gone through in the last generation, do you see women, particularly younger women, who are able to have both stable home lives and the freedom to live creatively?
I think they've gotten the message that you can have it all, but you can't have it all at once. You really have to put your life together in increments. I think the experience of the parents of baby boomers was that, and a lot of early baby boomers, was trying to have marriage, family, career, and, you know, continued schooling all at the same time in the 20s, and it just, it was impossible to create a balance, and particularly since if you were in a marriage, it takes a long time to just get used to being part of a couple, and then adding the, you know, demands of a young child, you know, financially, socially, psychologically, fatigue-wise, then just puts so much pressure on. So we've seen the age of marriage, you know, rise quite dramatically over the last 15 or 20 years. And so many women saying, you know, I'd like to have a family at some point, but I really have to get this career apprenticeship under my belt. I really like to travel. I want to take another language. And later, some women in the early baby boom generation got caught in that pass and got to 40 or so and said, oops, I think I might have missed the boat. And they often have a child or adopt a child on their own. So I think the young women who are now in Gen X, in their teens up to mid-20s, are really saying, I don't want to work. I don't want to kill myself working 70 hours a week. I don't want to get into that kind of career track, and I don't think I have to because I can start my own website or cut my own demo or make my own movie. And it might be easier to put that together with a family life. That's one solution that has become so popular. And you have to be pretty talented to pull that off. And others are quite free to say, I'm absolutely going to go just for my career direction, and I'm going to sacrifice marriage and family, at least for now. I'll revisit that later on, but I really want to be president by the time I'm 31, or not president of the United States, but president of my company. So there are now some multiple paths that are quite acceptable that women are choosing without guilt that just weren't available to women before. And I do think, though, that it's important to say one of the most common topics that I'm asked to speak about is, you know, balancing your life, getting the right balance, you know. Well, it's a lifelong struggle. You know, let's don't delude ourselves into thinking there is the perfect solution. There isn't. You may have a solution that works really well for 2 or 3 years, and then, boom, you know, your husband is laid off, and you have to work full-time despite the fact that you have a 2-year-old at home, whether you, you know, even if, though it may conflict with your philosophy of life. Or you're a woman, a seasoned woman, who's just broke loose at 50, 51, and you've figured this is your second chance to really pursue your passion, and you started a new business, and you have a new romance, or you're dating online, and everything is going swimmingly, and you're off into your second adulthood with booster rockets behind you, and then your mother falls and needs full-time caregiving. Or your father develops Alzheimer's, or your husband has a life-threatening diagnosis, and you are thrust back into the caregiving role just as your life is taking off into its second adulthood. So then you have to renegotiate the balance all over again, and you're in disequilibrium. You're in a passage until you can resolve it at some point. So, you know, we have to sort of take the pressure off ourselves and say, when you hit one of these upsets where you simply can't keep all the plates spinning in the air, and they begin crashing around you, you really have to think about taking care of yourself, even as you are trying to pick up the pieces. Because if you get sick or you get really overtired, you're going to blow it. And it's not your fault. It's just, it happens. It's life.
I think one of the things that is so clear for, in everything that you're saying is that women especially have to make their own path. There's not a path that's really laid out for them. It requires a lot more creativity and a lot more decision-making than perhaps one or two generations earlier.
That's exactly right. But they do have the opportunity to choose many different variations on a path that really weren't open to women back when I wrote Passages. I mean, you couldn't make a deal then with your employer to work 4 days a week while you have you're raising your first child. It just very rarely was granted. You know, you had a baby, you wanted extra time, you were off the payroll. You didn't feel that you could make the choice to forego marriage and family until you reached a career goal, because you would really be, well, you were, you know, you'd be an old maid at 28, and you'd be out of the link with your friends, all of whom would be coupling up. Well, now, you know, young people travel in packs, and they are committed to their friendships, their friendship network, beyond being committed to any company, because they don't believe any company is going to return their loyalty, and they're right. And so there is, you know, whether they're married or single or adopting a child or, you know, putting away sperm in a sperm bank until later, they still are part of a network of friends. And that's a wonderful insulation for young people during this much longer period of exploration that they go through today.
We're talking to Gail Sheehy, and she will be speaking at the James A. Little Theater next week. It's Wednesday, the 7th of March, sponsored by the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum at the James A. Little Theater at 7 o'clock in the evening. You've seen, obviously, many marriages fall apart. You've also seen many others stay together. Do you see any patterns, both on the personal level and on the larger sociological level, about what binds couples and what tears them apart?
Well, one thing that I found in writing Sex and the Seasoned Woman, which was very interesting, and it was through interviewing sociologists and psychologists that this was pinned down. If a couple, you know, the big question in a seasoned marriage is, can we revitalize this? You know, will sex ever be as exciting as it was? Do we still have that passion for each other that we did when we were, you know, standing on the beach with flowers in your hair and having our own creative marriage ceremony? Well, if a couple has ever felt chemistry beyond all rational explanation, even if it goes dormant for decades, it can be revived. And it happened over and over again with people that I interviewed. And it might be something as simple as, you know, being at a graduation of one of their children and just feeling a resurgence of their connection through this, producing this gifted child. Or it might be being in a climactic event and both of them looking at each other at one point and realizing they were both taking it in the same way. And they had this connection, soul connection, that was beyond what they had with anyone else. And then you can build on that with you know, taking vacations and being more conscious of how to flirt with each other and taking off some of the armor to have more of an intimate connection, and perhaps giving up some of the bad habits that people take on to hide themselves from intimacy. So many ways, but if you've never had chemistry as a couple, but you really came together and sort of on more practical grounds or shared interests or shared family background, you really can't revive it because it never was there in the first place. The second thing I'd say about, you know, how marriage is different today when people are reexamining it for their second adulthood is 2/3 of the marriages that break up in the 40s today are initiated by the wives. And that is really new. And why? Because they can. And the main reasons are nothing frivolous. It's because the man is either a chronic alcoholic, abuser, adulterer, or unable to make a living. And previously, women would pretty much just roll over and stay in the bed they'd made and be miserable. Now they have the independence or the capacity to get the education, to gain the financial independence, to get out of a marriage that is dead or abusive. And they also see that they have, well, my goodness, in their 40s, they have 40 or 50 more years to live. So there's every reason to want to reinvest in a second adulthood that takes a different path.
Now, do the life passages that you describe in your books vary? I would think they would have to with factors like social class and ethnicity. For example, let's say one woman who's 45 is a working class Latina with an extended family, a large number of children, and so on, all living near each other. Another woman the same age is a college-educated white person who's transplanted in a new city, has one child who's already gone. And it seems like there are real factors that have to do with ethnicity and class.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are, and they set up different kinds of needs. I would say that with a working-class Latino woman who has a large extended family all living close together, one thing she probably doesn't have to worry about is the caregiving responsibility that the white mom whose child is gone and maybe taking off on a great career when her mom suddenly needs all kinds of caregiving and management of her care, which may be long distance. The Latina woman with an extended family has plenty of people around to pitch in when life crises come up. So she may be even in a better position to pursue her passion in her work or outside than the white mom who has more financial resources but doesn't have as many social resources.
Now, the full title of your most recent book is Sex and the Seasoned Woman, Pursuing the Passionate Life. Is the passionate life necessarily associated with sex?
No. Actually, the pursuing the passionate life begins with finding your passion. And that is, to me, the sine qua non. That is the beginning. That is the basis. That's the core of re-enlivening your life for a second adulthood. Most of us women spend most of our first adulthood pleasing those people who protect and reward us, starting with parents and then teachers and mentors and bosses and then husbands and children. And when we get to second adulthood, we are still going to want to please some people, but we're much more selective, and as one of my interviewees said, the rest can just go fly a kite. Because what you get to in your second adulthood as a woman, passing 50, is you want to move from pleasing to mastery. Mastery of your environment, of your work life, of your interior emotional life, of your relationships. And that is something that women do as they move into their 50s and 60s. And interestingly, the majority of women, and this is established by the long longitudinal MacArthur study, the majority of women reach a major goal in life in their 50s or 60s, which is really quite late because it takes us longer. And that's part of the mastery thing. So pursuing the passionate life begins with finding your passion in the second half, and it may be colored by what you loved doing when you were a teenager. I can't tell you how many women I've interviewed who go back to doing something with horses. They raise horses, or they board horses, or they ride horses, or they take care of sick horses.
Right.
Others learn to fly or go back to playing the piano and dancing, guitar playing, climbing a mountain, lots of physical things. And then many others always love to play store, and now they want to start their own business. They don't want to work for somebody 9-to-5 anymore.
I mean, a lot of the things you're talking about, horseback riding and guitar playing and hiking and so on, those are avocations. I would think that women who've gone into the professions, such as science or journalism, or like you, have pursued mastery quite a lot earlier than the 50s.
Well, yes, we do, but there's also a change in the ratio between pleasing others and, doing what you do conforming to either institutional or corporate goals for you, or let's say as a writer, you don't have the same freedom to say, you know, I'm going to write about, you know, one-eyed redheads, and I don't care if the publisher doesn't think that's a big seller. I really want to write about one-eyed redheads, so I'm going to do it on my website, or I'm going to self-publish. And I think you have to have some sense of your own worth and priorities and be willing to take risks in order to master something that you've never done before. It's hard to do that when you're younger and trying to prove yourself, and there's a lot of rules that you have to play by.
Now, do you think it's equally or somewhat as hard for men trying to achieve mastery at different points in their lives?
Well, for men, the mastery comes emotionally. you know, men work very hard in at competition from a very, very early age, in, you know, physical competition and business competition and so on. And they, you know, adhering to male codes, even though they're doing so less and less, you know, they mask their emotions, they put armor on, they deny their emotions to themselves. They don't even know how to identify or recognize an emotion. They're often really astonished as they get into second adulthood that, you know, they've been seething with resentment all these years about something or other, or that they're really scared, or that they're really sad. They've been walking around with a big lump of sadness all their life because their mom died when they were 11 years old. So the mastery comes with taking the risk of allowing those emotions to come to the surface, begin to express them, find friends that you can, that a man can confide in. And if he has more than four friends, he will live longer than if he has fewer than four friends.
Interesting.
So I think the mastery comes in. And then also men, as they get older, are more nurturing. They do begin to reveal more of their nurturing side, even as they need more nurturing. And they also very often manifest more of their artistic and creative side, which also is often shortchanged while they were conforming to the codes of manhood and competition in their early life.
The way you're talking about it, it sounds like there's sort of a mirror image that men and women have of one another. I mean, probably a large number of women have the emotional stuff pretty much down pat by the time they're 40, whereas men are just beginning to discover some of that stuff,
right.
Whereas women are starting to master the real world a little bit later.
Exactly. Well, I've been saying for a very long time this simple mirror image that you're talking about, and it's documented as being cross-culturally true.
Really?
Yeah, as women get older, past 50, they become more aggressive, more managerial, more political, and men mature in the opposite direction. They become more nurturing and in need of nurturing, more expressive artistically, more aware of their surroundings. So there is a mirror image, and I think it's one of the reasons that seasoned marriages, if they were ever good in the past, can become the richest, wonderful, a third and stronger element than just two people coming together, because they bring everything to the table, and they can exchange. They have many more colorations, and there isn't the same kind of tension between who's the boss and who's the passive one. You know, it passes back and forth.
How much of those this phenomenon that you say is cross-culturally true, how much of that do you think is just purely hormonal?
A lot of it is hormonal. Absolutely true. As women move through menopause, as their estrogen level goes down, the ratio of testosterone, what we consider the male hormone, is higher. And so there's just much more, you know, fuel, kind of assertive fuel in the tank. And as men age, they go through a slower but very definitive male menopause, and their testosterone levels decline somewhat. They have estrogen, so that their estrogen level is a little bit higher in ratio than it was when they were younger. And, of course, they may then take supplements that put the testosterone back up high, but it doesn't last all the time. So there is a hormonal change. And one of the other things that happens is, you know, women have this very interesting thing in the brain where the two sides of the brain have a bridge that where the fluids go back and forth between the two sides very much more easily. So you kind of think, I think, in terms of women having a kind of a 360-degree view oscillating all the time. That's what makes us so good at taking care of children and, you know, looking out for what's going on behind us. And that was, I'm sure, programmed in by nature because we were, you know, the ones who birthed the offspring. Whereas men, hormonally, are geared to looking kind of with blinders on, in long distance, out in front, chasing the wild animal, throwing their spear at it, and either felling it or getting felled. So they have to, which makes them very, very good at, you know, attack and protection of the young in a different way. Well, they have to learn more about this 360-degree view in order to know themselves and others better. And hormonally, that does begin to change after their contribution to the species is dwindling. And women become better able to narrow their focus and really concentrate on a direction and not be swayed or distracted by trying to take care of everything else around them.
We're talking to author, journalist, and cultural observer Gail Sheehy, who will be in town next week at the James A. Little Theater on Wednesday night. As I was reading Sex and the Seasoned Woman and all these stories of women having romances in their 50s and 60s and even later, I wondered, and I'm not at that life stage myself, and I may feel very differently in 10 or 20 or 30 years, but I was wondering if there isn't a kind of denial of age and the stages of life that is going on in women who maybe didn't have what they wanted at the time when it was appropriate. And part of the reason I ask this is because I was asked last year to join a women's group, and I asked if there were going to be any young women in the group, and the person who called me said, well, I consider myself young, and she was 61. And I thought, what's what's going on there? Is there a little bit of denial going on as well?
No, I think she was actually very contemporary. Let me tell you something. When AARP tapped their vast resource of people 50 and over and asked, when will you be old? The number that came back was 79. So what you have now is boomers really beginning to see themselves as in midlife from roughly the late 40s to the brink of the 80s. And they are young in that they still see that they, you know, they can be sexual, they can be flirtatious, they can start a new relationship, they can start a new business, they can start a new career, they can move to another part of the country and start living in a different way. They are free to do these things because they have the longevity that has shot up in the last 100 years in the most astonishing way.
That doesn't make them young, though. I mean, it makes them young at heart, but a 61-year-old isn't
that because you're young and you don't want to be associated with people who are 61. That's just the way it is.
Well, I don't want to be associated with 61-year-olds who think they're 35.
Who says she thinks she's 35?
Well,
she just thinks she's still young at 61. And if she is still energetic and healthy and sees that she has many opportunities to reshape her life, then she has a young viewpoint. Who is to say when young stops? Is it the number of wrinkles you have? Is it the, you know, exact angle at which your breasts hang? Or is it the the spirit that you have, that you express and communicate to others?
Well, it's a longer conversation. I mean, I sort of think of it as the childbearing years or afterwards. But let's move on. There's so many other things. First of all, it seems like a lot of women are very interested in your work, in the real life stories and the sociological analysis with which they can identify. Have you found men to be equally receptive and interested in examining the meaning of their life stages?
Yes, I have. I wrote a book called Understanding Men's Passages about 7 years ago, and it was one of the most interesting projects I ever worked on. And the men I interviewed were often in groups first, and before I went into one-on-one interviews, and they were just so relieved to be with a group of strangers. These were not men who knew one another. And we'd get together in a hotel suite, and I'd have sports on, and they'd stand, you know, like shoulder to shoulder and commenting on sports until they felt a little more comfortable. Then we'd sit down, they'd have a glass of wine, and then somebody would just, you know, plunge in and say, "Oh my God, you know, I'm 50 years old and I feel like I'm totally over, and I just don't have it anymore." And then others will chime in and talk about their fear of loss of potency in all areas of their lives, and then others will say, "Well, here's how I got through that stage," and so on. So I think more and more men are beginning to recognize that they have to expect that there is going to be a change in status, and if they read that as a change in self-worth, as their status or prestige of their title is changed, if they wait for it to happen to them and then mark themselves down because they didn't become president or they didn't become, you know, the best earner on the block, or they will go into a decline and very often into depression and very often into premature death. And I think that more and more men are beginning to pick up those messages and signals through TV and through a lot of health awareness, and saying, "Well, maybe I should rethink the second half of my life before it happens to me. Maybe I should be in charge of this change, preempt the change before it happens to me." But for instance, in academia, it can be done fairly naturally. You know, most deans like to retire from that position at some point, often in their 40s. They're tired of just being the administrator. They really want to get back to some teaching and some research, and meanwhile they can keep their own office, and there's no loss of prestige or status, and they get back to being kind of on the front line. And I think a lot of men in corporate life would like that option too, rather than waiting to see if they're the one that makes the cut that gets to the very top of the pile, and if they don't, feeling that they are really failures.
We're talking to Gail Sheehy. One thing we haven't talked about yet is your journalistic studies of political figures. And I remember actually in October 2000 reading the Vanity Fair issue that you wrote about then-Governor George W. Bush, whom you described as running for governor because he didn't get the job of baseball commissioner, and who was so competitive that as a young person he would basically redo the rules when he lost a game, whether it was tennis or anything else. How do you see him as president now compared to the governor that you portrayed at the time?
Well, it's true that he did want to be baseball commissioner more than anything else, and I think he would have been really terrific at that job. I think he was much better suited at that job than the one he has. The fact, I think the most significant thing I found about him in terms of his pattern of behavior was just what you mentioned, that he was so hyper-competitive that whatever game he was playing, whether it was tennis or tiddlywinks or baseball, he if he wasn't winning, this was the point of it, that he could not lose. He could not admit anything other than victory. And in so doing, he would either, if you were playing three sets of tennis and he was lost, then you'd have to play five sets, and you'd play right through into a snowstorm. If he would tell jokes or he would do bad behavior, so his mother would make him go home before he finished the golf game, or he would change the score, and nobody really dared to call him on it. And if all else was lost, he would just take his bat and ball and go home. Well, where do we see this kind of behavior manifest now that he's president of the United States?
Well, the Florida
he can't go
election
home
2000.
From Iraq.
The Florida election 2000 comes to mind.
That's true. The Florida election right. of 2000. Exactly. He couldn't lose, and he had enough powerful friends to change the rules and make sure that he didn't lose. Very good example. And then, what is the single biggest factor that has, caused our country to go into such disastrous times and disfavor around the world is the war in Iraq. Once he was on that course, we were going to be victorious. He was going to be a winner. And when he's already, got the alibi out there, the war in Iraq is going to have to go on, and he's going to have to pass it on to the next president because he's still going to be victorious. He is going to be proven right in the end.
Your article in the January Vanity Fair of this year is about Congressman Mark Foley, and it paints a picture of it's unbelievable. I mean, I'd read stories, but I had not read it as clearly as in your article. Basically, you're looking at a sexual predator and alcoholic having cyber sex with teenage boys and then going to vote on the legislation by which we are governed. What difference do you think the exposure of the Foley scandal made on our country, if any?
Well, I think it exposed something that we know, and it just repeats itself, which is when a party is in power for too long, they just don't think the rules apply to them anymore. And with Mark Foley, because he was so popular in his district in Florida and made his House seat so safe, the Republican Party leaders completely violated their own stated codes of ethics and behavior and family values by knowing that he was gay and knowing that he was in the closet and knowing that he was behaving very badly for a very long time. And the Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, had been warned about that for up to 5 years before the Foley scandal broke open, and just stopped the phone calls, put the earplugs in, refused to deal with it. So they let him go on, actually, maligning the very young people who we want to train and inspire as the future leaders of America, the interns, going after them with emails and whether they were gay or straight, and taking advantage of his power position, what these young people who wanted to please a powerful member of Congress, and really messing up their heads. So we finally, this whole thing was exposed, and I think it was extremely painful to many Republicans who many of the Republicans who supported him in Florida, because they had no idea how out of control his behavior was. And his denial was so overwhelming that it wasn't until his chief of staff had to confront him face-to-face and say, you have to resign right now. And he said, you mean from running for president? He said, no, from the House, from your seat in the House of Representatives, that he finally broke down and cried and signed the paper and escaped in a car with his sister to Florida, never to be seen in public again.
Now, whether it be, let's get back to the question of women again, whether it be in politics or business, Washington, D.C., Hillary Clinton, I mean, she's an exception in a way, but women are still very much underrepresented in positions of power and leadership, and there's still a prejudice against older people, older workers at every level. Do you see this changing in any way?
Yes, I do. I'm so glad you asked that. the age phobia in corporations and age discrimination is about to undergo a revolutionary change, or at least a transformation. The fact is that we are at a crossover point between supply and demand of workers. The baby boom generation was so huge that as the senior managers and leaders and skilled personnel begin to move towards early retirement or begin to drop off the radar because they were in positions that were eliminated because of restructuring or various other corporate ins and outs, there will not be enough people in Gen Y to fill those positions. Certainly not enough people with college degrees and with the skills and experience and institutional knowledge that the boomers have in the who hold those positions now. So corporations are beginning now, the smart ones, to look at how can they retain or hire boomer women in particular and men over 50, over 55, and make it appealing to them to come back to the corporate world. Because many of them feel burnt out, they're tired, they never got to where they wanted to go, they don't want to work 50-hour weeks anymore, they want to have time for online dating and for their grandchildren and for going to the spa. They want project-based work, cyclical work, so that they can take intermissions and follow their passion. So I just came back from a wonderful conference of 30 American and British companies, big companies, American Express, Time Warner, British Petroleum, Alcoa, talking about how they need to think differently about the older workforce, the older boomers, and lure them back and work with them to redefine work because they're desperately going to need them or they're going to really be caught short with a shrinking workforce.
It's so interesting because I just read Bait and Switch by Barbara Ehrenreich, and that new movement that you're talking about had obviously not yet happened when she was writing about her attempts to, as an older woman, basically go undercover and find a job in the corporate world. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have very much time left, but I do want to just give you a little opportunity to talk about the fact that, along with everything else, you're also a playwright.
Well, an amateur one. That's my passion. It's a wonderful thing when you're, you know, sitting on the runway for an hour or two de-icing to go, you know, pull up my play and rewrite a scene. And I was just in the Mississippi Delta in the last couple of days making a speech, part of the country I'd never been to before. I became fascinated by the blues trail there, and that feeds into my play, and so I just stayed an extra half day to do research.
Well, the music is on, so I guess it's time to go. Gail Sheehy, thank you so much for being with us for the full hour here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
Well, Mary Charlotte, it's been a delight. Hope to see you next week.
We will see you then. Gail Sheehy is author, journalist, and cultural observer. She's an author of many books, including the bestseller Passages and most recently Sex and the Seasoned Woman. And she will be speaking on Wednesday, March 7th at the James A. Little Theater, sponsored by the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. The talk is called The Pursuit of the Passionate Life. That's at 7 o'clock. You can call 988-1234 for more information and tickets. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Tim Pemberton for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. tomorrow, the inimitable Robert Knott, and all sorts of other good things. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR. Hasta la vista. Ciao.